Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. From kangaroos bred in captivity to trained tigers, exotic pets come from all walks of wildlife. And ownership of wild animals is increasingly becoming a hot debate. Exotic pet owners defend their right to care for critters from venomous snakes to angry chimps. Animal rights advocates, meanwhile, are doing what they can to stop the purchase of exotic pets and to place current ones into safe, accredited sanctuaries. However, both camps appear to share a love of wild animals. Joining us is Lauren Slater, an animal lover herself, who wrote about the exotic animal ownership debate for National Geographic. Lauren Slater, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you looked into some of the motivations for why people buy and keep exotic pets. What did you find?
I found that there were a couple of different motivations. I mean, the ones that come immediately to my mind are some people buy exotic pets as a sort of status symbol, keeping up with the Joneses type of thing. If the neighbor has, a Bengal cat, then the other person's going to go out and purchase a cougar, just to one-up them sort of thing. And while that sounds strange, that really is a motivation. I mean, there's something exotic and certainly expensive about having, say, a wild cat. But the most common motivation had to do with people falling in love with these animals when they're babies, the mammals especially, like the tigers and the cat. And then taking them home and raising them. The problem, of course, comes in these animals don't stay babies. They grow up and they reach sexual maturity, and then oftentimes problems begin.
Right. They sort of treat them as surrogate children. And eventually, I guess, these children have to be sometime declawed or defanged.
Yeah, and even then, you can declaw, defang, de-whatever your exotic or wild animal, but you can't take its genetic material out of it. And I'm thinking of Michelle Burke, who I interviewed, who had a kinkajou, which is a relatively small animal, wild animal. And the kinkajou's name was Winnie, and she was a beloved family pet. They actually bought her on Craigslist, and they dressed her up in clothes and, anthropomorphized her in all sorts of ways. And then Winnie, at some point, a couple of years down the road, went into her first heat. And she started attacking them and also attacking herself out of just sheer kind of hormonal frustration. Mm. And that was a terrifying experience for the family. This beloved, sweet kinkajou just became a raging monster. And they gave her up after that.
Well, there are some very gruesome tales of exotic animals turning on their owners. Apparently, there's a database. What can you tell us about that, and what kind of things get recorded?
Well, first of all, that database is at Born Free USA, and you can go online and look it up. But the first thing you need to know about that database is it's probably radically incomplete. Born Free USA only reports on reported incidences. It's safe to assume that the vast majority of these incidences go unreported. So obviously Born Free USA has no way of knowing how many, violent incidences actually occur with exotic animals as pets. Mm. Again, they report on the ones that make it into the news or the newspaper. And even with that severe limitation on what they can list, there's still, you go on that site and you look at the incidences and it's, someone in Arizona was gutted to death by his kangaroo, by his pet kangaroo. Someone had their hand bitten off by a bear. Three venomous snakes were found in the, waiting area of the airport. And the list goes on and on.
Wow. Well, what are the current regulations for purchasing and caring for exotic animals?
Well, I think one of the problems with the regulations is that they're not at all consistent from state to state. I live in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, it's 100% clear. It's 100% illegal to have any kind of wild animal as a pet. And I think it's the same for New Hampshire. But, for instance, in Ohio, there used to be no regulations on whether or not you could have wild animals. And Ohio, in fact, is full of people who have wild or exotic animals as pets.
Remind us of that story, that gruesome story in Ohio from a couple years ago that set the regulations off.
A man named Jerry Thompson had a menagerie of wild animals on his property. And that actually is not so uncommon. These people who have wild animals as pets will sometimes actually kind of collect them. So he had a large collection of wild animals, tigers, other kinds of large cats, zebras. I mean, it was truly a menagerie. And for whatever reason, and no one really knows what his motivations were, what was going on with him, he let them all loose, you know, 20 or 30 of these wild animals that were living in enclosures on his property in Zanesville, Ohio. Zanesville is not the country, it's a suburb. He let them all loose, and then he killed himself. He shot himself. There were people going to work in Zanesville, and the animals were running in front of cars, and there was a good chance they were going to attack, you know, an unsuspecting citizen. So the sheriff's department really felt they had no choice but to slaughter all of the animals to kill them.
So as a result, Ohio's kind of clamping down on the exotic pet ownership. What are they doing?
Well, the first thing I think they did was they made it illegal to have wild animal auctions. And now they are requiring that all wild animal owners register their animals with a central registry and also pay something like $3 to $5 million in insurance to have these animals, which makes it pretty much impossible to have. I mean, not many people can afford to buy insurance like that.
We're speaking with Lauren Slater. She's an author of several books and also an article in the current National Geographic about exotic animal ownership and the debate going on in several places about whether or not people should be allowed to keep exotic animals. Lauren, you write in your article that it's believed that more exotic animals live in American homes than are cared for in American zoos. What is the case that wild animal owners are making for why they should be allowed to keep these animals?
Well, there's a group called REXANA, which stands for Responsible Exotic Animal Ownership. The case that they make and the case that other people who own these exotic animals would make is that, number one, the number of violent incidences that happen with these exotic animals is actually lower than the number of violent incidences that happen with domestic animals. Hmm. So if you go on Born Free USA's website and you look at their incidences of wild animal attacks on human beings, you'll find, you know, hundreds of incidences listed there, but there are more incidences of people visiting the ER for, say, dog bites. Hmm. The other argument that they make is that it's, you know, it's within their rights as, you know, a United States citizen to own these animals, and restricting them from owning them is in interfering with their, you know, personal freedom that comes with being a citizen of the United States. And a third argument would be that wild animals have been kept by humans and human civilizations for as long as civilization has been around, which is about 12 or 13,000 years. So there's a long history to this. You know, but again, it comes back to the baseline argument, is that it's no more or less safe or unsafe than having a dog or a cat.
How about the argument against wild animal ownership made by animal rights activists?
Well, there's a lot of arguments, but I think the first one is that there is a big difference between a domesticated and a wild animal. Of all of the large land mammals that roam this earth, and there are, you know, hundreds, only 13 of them, I think, have been successfully domesticated over thousands and thousands of years. To domesticate an animal takes thousands and thousands of years of culling from the gene pool and selective breeding. So a domesticated animal has a different genome from a wild animal. And when you take a wild animal and put it into a domestic situation, its natural inclinations, its very genetic structure does not mesh with a domestic situation. In other words, it's meant to be a wild animal. It's not meant to live in captivity. It's not going to flourish in captivity, and therefore presents dangers in captivity to both the owner and to the animal. You know, a couple of years ago, I'm sure some of your listeners, or maybe all of them, heard of the terrible incident with the chimpanzee in Connecticut.
Oh, right. He mauled a woman's face.
Terribly mauled a woman. Now, that chimpanzee, you know, needed to be killed. So, you know, it came to a terrible, terrible end for both the chimpanzee primate and the human primate. So, you know, these are some of the arguments against it. It's not good for humans, and it's not good for animals.
Lauren Slater, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Lauren Slater is the author of several books, including most recently The $60,000 Dog, My Life with Animals. She wrote the article called Wild Obsession, which is about the debate over owning exotic animals. It's in the current issue of National Geographic. We have a link to her article and more, including some fantastic photographs of animals in captivity from the article. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Most Americans don't have to go home to walk the kangaroo or feed the boa constrictor, but we are wild for animals. The American Pets Production Association estimates that 68% of U.S. households own a pet, over 83 million dogs among them. Joining me now is one such dog owner, Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby, who's got a little show and tell of sorts, or I don't know, I guess we should call it a play and listen.
Yeah, so I should just, I have a dog, she's about 8 pounds, she's half Chihuahua, half something else, we don't know, she's kind of a mutt. And she makes a lot of funny noises, as many pets do, but especially when she's begging for attention, specifically if she wants to be pet, she makes a sound that sounds nothing like a dog. Take a listen.
Objectively, if I was listening to this, it kind of sounds like somebody unzipping a sleeping bag.
It does sound like a zipper, like a tent or a sleeping bag zipper.
It sounds exactly like a tent.
What's your dog's name?
Angel.
All right, we're going to throw the challenge out to you. Does your pet make a weird sound? Maybe your cat sounds something like this. Oh my God. Or maybe your dog sounds something like a woman wailing. Or maybe you have a pet goat and it sounds just like a shouting man.
Oh, that's my favorite one. I hope somebody out there has a pet goat.
Is that real?
Yeah.
How can that be real?
Oh, YouTube.
All right, so prove it yourself. Go to the voice memo feature on your smartphone and hit record. Or take a video of your pet in action and then send it to us. There are step-by-step instructions to do so on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, thank goodness. It's officially spring, but there is still one winter visitor worth checking out before the snowbanks melt. Local birders have observed a rare influx of snowy owls in the Granite State this year. To find out more, I sat down with Eric Masterson. He's protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. It's a hyper-local guide to the best birding spots and events the state has to offer. Eric, great to have you back with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Virginia.
Reports of snowy owls spotted as far south as North Carolina, far east as Bermuda.
Yeah, well, actually, even further than that now, there was a sighting in Florida. You don't
Wowie.
Think snowy and Florida in the same sentence. So they're coming from the Arctic. They breed along the Arctic Rim and up into the Canadian archipelago in the Arctic Ocean, and they migrate south every winter to a varying degree. This winter, just to give you a sense of scale, in New Hampshire, on a single day in December, 12 birds were counted. The previous max in the records is 3 birds. So just an unprecedented invasion.
Well, and then news this week that 100 have been caught at Logan Airport.
That's
and
right, just this winter.
Elsewhere in Mass. This was after 3 were killed at JFK Airport by officers there.
Yeah.
That of course, attracted a huge outcry. But what is it about airports that is drawing the snowy owl?
Well, the you know, we have dramatically altered the landscape in this region of the continent. The thing about airports is that the grassland habitat mimics what they're used to in the Arctic. And so it's kind of one of the remaining habitats that they would naturally be predisposed to occupying during the winter.
Any theories as to why the sudden increase this year?
So the current thinking is that there was a record bumper crop of lemmings last year in the Arctic, which is a chief food resource for these birds. And so any given year, snowy owls will lay anywhere from 0 to 11 eggs. You know, if their prey is abundant, they can have success with all 11. In rare cases, with all 11 hatching. In years where there's very little food, they can have a bust and not raise any young at all. And last year was a super successful year, and so there was a very high rate of fledging. So all those birds need to disperse in the winter, and they come far. The there was more birds to disperse farther south. That was really the reasons for the phenomenal influx, because it was a huge, hugely successful breeding season.
So if we went through the food chain, why so many more lemmings? I'm just wondering, because they are coming from the Arctic Circle, and I know that there's been a great deal of change climatically in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, and scientists don't really have a good take on that, why lemmings have this huge boom-bust cycle. The owl's cycle is related to the lemmings, but why the lemmings boom-bust is not properly understood at the moment.
Are there so many lemmings here in New Hampshire?
No, we don't have lemmings in New Hampshire.
So I'm guessing they're eating on small mice, rodents, voles.
Yeah, rodents, voles, and actually a lot of seabirds. With recent satellite telemetry, Norm Smith, the chap in Logan, who catches the owls and releases them elsewhere on Plum Island, for instance, has been attaching satellite transmitters. And so we're learning more about their habits. And some birds have been documented going out to sea at night and catching seabirds. And actually, if you spend time on the coast looking for these owls, you can find little graveyards of seabird wings and legs where snowy owls have been feasting during the night.
Tell us a little bit more about the snowy owl, however. How big do they get, and what makes catching sight of them such a unique experience for bird watchers and non-birders?
Well, they're an owl, and so normally owls, you think of, we have about 8 species that have occurred over the course of, history in New Hampshire, and most of those are nocturnal. They're active during the nighttime. Snowy owl is the exception. It's active also during the daytime, and so it's an owl you can see. It's exotic. It comes from a place that, we don't get to visit. It's huge. It's pretty striking, too, you got to admit, with those big yellow saucer eyes. And you can, because they're from the Arctic, where humans tend not to, where they're not habituated to humans, they don't have a fear of humans to a great extent. And so you can get incredibly close to them. I'm not advocating people do. They need to rest and refuel when they're here during the winter. But they do allow close approach. And so, they're highly photogenic. People just are attracted to them. What can I say?
Any advice about tracking the snowy owl here in New Hampshire?
Yes. Actually, they'll be departing now towards early April. They'll be heading back north. But there have been a couple of reliable sites to find them in New Hampshire. Probably the best place now is Rye Harbor State Park. It's a tiny little state park just north of the marina. And there has been a bird there for the last 3 months holding court. And it was there as recently as 2 days ago. And Rye Harbor State Park, for folks who don't know, is very small. It's about a 10 or 11 acre park, so you can't miss it. And actually, if you're looking for a snowy owl, don't look for the owl. Look for the photographers, the phalanx of paparazzi that are following this bird around. That's all you need to find. And that's probably the best place. Plum Island is always a good spot, even in down years when there aren't many snowy owls in New England. Plum Island usually has a few. And Salisbury State Park in Massachusetts also is a good spot.
Mm-hmm. Is this the best time in general for bird watchers?
Oh, it is, especially with the winter we've had. It's been a really cruel winter. I think people are just tired of it. And we're going to be here. We already have seen the first blackbirds returning, and we're going to be seeing phoebes coming very shortly. Bluebirds are starting to nest shortly. And the next 2 months will be tremendously exciting for bird watching.
Well, you can find out more in Eric Masterson's book, Bird Watching in New Hampshire. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Virginia. Thanks so much.
Okay, after the break, we're going to move from raptors to retail with an exploration of the elusive no exceptions, no small print satisfaction guarantee. We're also going to test just how far L.L. Bean is willing to go when it comes to product returns. Stay with us for that.